Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Sarah McJewling, and we're sitting across from AJ Finn, who has written The Woman in the Window. Welcome, AJ.
Thank you for having me.
And this AJ business, are we allowed to go beyond the AJ business?
Yes.
Yeah, so we call you Dan?
Please do, yes.
Okay.
It's my real name, and I opted for a pseudonym because at the time The Woman in the Window was submitted to publishers, I was working in the publishing industry myself as a book editor specializing in crime and thriller fiction. I published everyone from J.K. Rowling, writing as Robert Galbraith, to Sarah Paretsky, to Patricia Cornwell, to the Agatha Christie estate. And so when it came time to submit my own novel to other publishers, I opted to go the pseudonym route because odds were excellent they would know me, and I didn't want anyone to say, we like Dan, so let's buy his book. Or more likely, we don't like Dan, let's not buy his book. Hence the pseudonym. And I looked to a cousin of mine named Alice Jane, who goes by AJ, selected that as my first name. And another cousin has a French bulldog called Finn. And I love French bulldogs because they're so ugly. And they can't breathe. It's like, which I found quite soothing, like white noise. They are the most popular breed in New York City where I live because they are portable and they don't bark and exercise literally kills them.
Wow.
They're like me.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're in a very privileged position here because a lot of the interviews done with you were done around the time of publication.
Yes.
And is this book going to be big or is it not? This book has been enormous.
It's
been
massive.
And it just keeps going.
Like, it does.
It just keeps selling on our side. And you see it and popping up into the bestseller list again and again. And,
yes.
All over the world.
Yep.
37 countries?
43.
Ooh.
Right. Yes.
43 countries.
It is my go-to, like, recommendation at the moment since I read it back earlier this year. And I'm absolutely safe in the knowledge that if anyone's like, what should I read, Sarah? I'm like, you gotta read The Woman in the Window.
Oh, that's great.
And they always
Thanks.
Come back and say, it's fantastic. Like, it's a winner. You can't go wrong.
Okay, so for those 6 or 7 people that are still out there listening to the podcast and haven't read it, can you give us just a tiny little bit of a
Sure.
teaser?
Basically, The Woman in the Window is Hitchcock's Rear Window for the 21st century. Our protagonist was once a respected child psychologist, but now she's been stricken with agoraphobia. She literally cannot set foot outside her house. And this proves problematic when she believes she witnesses a murder in a neighbor's home. She can't persuade anyone, including the police, to believe her, and soon she starts to doubt whether, in fact, she saw anything at all. So, is the danger real or imagined? That's the setup.
I revisited last night. I was dropping back into it. And what I love, what strikes me straight away is your obvious love of language. Like, it just comes,
yeah.
It comes out straight away. Cause I've heard you describe that you wrote a chapter, then edited that chapter, then wrote the next chapter, then edited that chapter, and there's a lot of work done. And it very much, like you, unless you switch on that brain, part of your brain which says, how's he doing this?
Mm.
It's absolutely flawless and flows beautifully. But if you're actually going, wanting to know, how the hell did he do this? And I want to be successful. And you're looking at the page. You can see it. You can see both. You can see the wonderful creative person that's within you, but also that next person that comes in and goes, how best to arrange this information? How best to write this sentence? And then what else can I put in to give, more detail, harsher darkness, greater light, but also the articulate, you're very articulate in person, but the way in which that you write shows that as well. There's this wonderful word choice the whole way through. And this is more than you get from your James Patterson. You know?
Well, and good luck noticing any of that the first time you read it, because you can't. Like,
this is my second time, so.
Yeah, but you'd have to, I would think that it would take a couple of reads before you get to the point of being just able to admire your writing, because it sucks you in this plot so much that there's not a chance to stop and admire the view or, like, question how you did it. For me, I was in it from the beginning and then all the way to the end.
Well, thank you both for lavishing such generous analysis on it. That's really kind of you. And I will say that I do love language. As a kid, I was faulted by my teachers for being too wordy. Fuck them.
Is there such a thing?
I've grown up. I've done fine.
What a great response.
Yes, thank you. I wish I'd said that at the time. There's my sophisticated vocabulary for you.
Fuck you.
Writing it as I did, in sequence, scribbling a chapter, revising it with my editor hat on, refining it, scribbling it again, and then moving on to the next one without revisiting the first chapter, did, I think, contribute to or help me achieve a certain seamlessness, what I hope comes off as a seamlessness. I think if I were to have written the entire book in one draft and then revised it as a second draft, I wouldn't have been able to concentrate as I did on each chapter. The book is, as you know, chopped up into 100 bite-sized chapters. Mm-hmm. And I've heard it theorized that if you've got quite a lot of tasks ahead of you in a given day, the best way to approach them is not in a big block, but to divide them into sort of micro-tasks. And that's how I approached the writing of this book.
Did you have an overview? Like, had you already plotted it? Or
yes.
Was it really just chapter by chapter?
No, I'd already plotted it before tapping out a single word of prose. I prepared a 7,500-word outline. And I was advantaged and really privileged in that I worked in the industry, as noted, and could reach out to an agent friend, as I did, to say, look, I prepared this outline for a book. Is it a goer? Because I don't want to pursue it if it isn't. Books take time to write. In this case, a year, which is actually pretty quick, all things considered. My second book is taking me ages. So she did think it was a goer, and I ended up proceeding with the outline. It was a 7,500-word outline, and the outline for my second book is 23,000 words, and The Woman in the Window itself is 90,000 words. So the second outline is a...
detail.
It's a novella. Yes. Yes.
That's cool.
So when editing... The authors, the crime authors, when you're working at Sphere and beyond, mm-hmm. There's a trend within, I think I first noticed it with Patricia Cornwell, mm-hmm. and then James Patterson took it to another level with that fast chapter
yes.
pace and scene. And then, and so you might have, in this book, you might have a chapter starting with a date mm-hmm. and then a couple of short chapters that revolve around that same time period.
Yes.
But they are separate. They're separate little chapters and they
yep. deal.
In examining it after what Sarah said earlier, because we often talk about this, that we devour a book and then we go back and go, how the hell did they do that?
You want to deconstruct it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So having come the second time, having a look at it, I felt that dragged me through it. Like I could not. I go, well, that chapter wasn't that long. I can stay up a little bit longer to read that. Just one more.
Perfect.
You know, and then
it's like a domino effect.
Yes, and then you just find yourself going, yeah. blah, 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 blah.
That is the desired effect, and it's a technique I did crib from Patterson, whose books I generally don't read. They're not quite my speed, but one does speed through them.
Yeah.
Another writer who employs this approach is Andrea Camilleri, a Sicilian detective writer. Every chapter is exactly 14 pages, and the print size is pretty generous. So once more, you say to yourself, I can read just one more. Just one more.
So your whole life, it seems, and we were privileged enough to have listened to you talk the other night, and you sort of discussed it. You didn't really realize that your whole life had been leading up to this, but you've been crime movie freak mm-hmm. as a kid. Mm-hmm. You loved it. Your holiday house was filled with crime novels.
Yes.
And you were just, like, the whole family were devoured by crime. A lot of that stuff would come via osmosis. So when you went to university to study it, mm-hmm. and then you were able to go down into the quantum physics of crime, you know,
yes,
examining
like
every single
much.
Particle
yep.
of it. When you were working with other writers and seeing their success and seeing the great prose coming through and helping them get it out to readers, mm-hmm. was there a writer inside going, look at me, I'm here, listen
Everything
to me.
You've just described, though, is the perfect crucible in which to build a crime writer.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
You can only emerge from all of those experiences, I think.
As a writer?
Yeah.
That's a really good question. I'll say this. I did not long to write. I didn't harbor some ambition to write, in part because in working with authors, I saw how thoroughly miserable many of them are. So that actually switched me off a bit. Also, to be an author is to construct one's own day, to discipline oneself, to impose an internal structure on your day, as opposed to going to a job, which I very much miss doing in many respects, not least because a structure is supplied for you to some extent. I also miss the interaction with former colleagues, and I miss a regular salary. As an author, you receive royalty checks at various times of the year. Financial planning, and I realize I'm getting into the weeds here, can be difficult. So that sort of switched me off. More importantly, though, more crucially, really, I didn't have a story. And as I mentioned the other night, for a long time, probably since at latest 1988, when Thomas Harris published The Silence of the Lambs, the crime thriller market was dominated by serial killer thrillers by the likes of Patricia Cornwell and James Patterson. And I enjoy a good serial killer thriller. I didn't have one in me. I'm not sick enough, I don't think, which is a good thing. Then in 2012, Gillian Flynn published Gone Girl, which inducted this mass global readership into the genre we now term psychological suspense. Here's the thing. As a graduate student at Oxford, I had written my PhD thesis on Patricia Highsmith, author of Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley, who was one of the pioneers of psychological suspense, a genre that, as I've argued, can be traced back, I think, to 1898 with The Turn of the Screw by Henry James. In any event, Highsmith really staked out fresh terrain within this genre, even though they didn't refer to it as psychological suspense back in the day. Ruth Rendell / Barbara Vine took up the mantle, and then Gillian Flynn blew it out of the water. I watched readers snap up this book and thought to myself, aha, there's demand for this genre that I have read and studied and loved. I wish I had a story, but I didn't. Over the course of my career, I had witnessed firsthand the copycat effect. So, for example, after 50 Shades of Grey became unaccountably popular, I was flooded with erotic thriller submissions, many of which were plainly smash-and-grab efforts. The authors had seen a trend and wanted to cash in on it. And there's nothing automatically disqualifying about such an approach. It's just not organic, and it didn't appeal to me, pretentious as that sounds. So a few years passed. The Girl on the Train attained juggernaut status. Again, I oohed and awed, and again, I thought, man, I wish I had a story, but I didn't. And it wasn't until a year later that this authentic narrative presented itself to me. That's when I started to write.
And it must be difficult being in that world and working with all these writers and working with editors and people who have aspirations everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of the reasons why you didn't verbalize it? You just sort of did the book? You spoke to a couple of friends and that's it, that they only knew, no one else knew in your life?
Oh, yes. No one actually knew aside from the agent whom I'd approached, a friend of mine. For a number of reasons. Principally, though, I thought it would redound somewhat negatively to me if it was discovered that I was writing a book on the side, and in particular, if that book was not acquired by publishers. Were I an author, and I am now an author, and were I to discover, as I have not discovered, that my editor was writing a book, I think I might feel a bit sidelined or a bit day job-ish. And one likes to think that one's editor is solely devoted to one's career. It's all well and good for an editor to pursue other interests. I wouldn't begrudge them that. But I think it would rattle me a bit, and I did not wish to rattle my authors. This is another reason I opted for a pseudonym. I thought it would be disconcerting for the authors whom I published to walk into a bookshop and see their editor's name writ large across a novel. Now that I've left my job, fuck them. I don't care.
when you talk about studying Patricia Highsmith, when I read Ripley,
mm-hmm.
it came out of nowhere. I was just in my secondhand bookshop and I picked it up one day and went, holy hell, and just got sucked in.
And was this as a result of the movie?
No.
It was
just surrounded by books all the time. I would pick up whatever came in. I would just pick up and have a look, a couple of pages. No, not for me.
Right.
It's the luxury of having a second-hand bookshop.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, I've never read anything like this. And this is another level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extraordinary. But it also then creeped me out for ages afterwards when I was just watching everybody and not believing anything they ever said.
They're all sociopaths.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. And you start to, because if you go in deep, that's all you start to see.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Sarah and I have been, we get some listens on our podcast, but we're not a true crime podcast, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we could possibly go down that line. So while thinking this morning, I was thinking, I started to present this story around you because not only are you extraordinarily successful, you're goddamn good looking.
Oh, right? Go on.
You're young.
No, keep going.
This is going in such an interesting direction.
This is great. This is the best podcast I've ever done.
Well, I just want some of that true crime cred, right? So if we were to uncover, we'll get the scoop here, and you know, it's an open. You're rich enough to run, right?
Yeah.
You've got opportunities to tell us the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a manuscript turns up on your desk.
Yes.
You think, wow, you've got all the elements here, but you can't write. You're an idiot. But the story is fantastic.
Yep.
You have an interview with that person,
mm-hmm.
right? You're walking across a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a small guy.
I'm not.
Maybe the person's a small woman. Maybe the person's a small man. Maybe he's your size. You give him a nudge, into the river he goes.
Sure. Right?
Are you writing a murder story?
I'm just thinking.
He's describing his Tuesday night.
Yes. Right. Yeah. I'm trying to get us here to for a scoop here.
Yep.
Did you write this book? Is it yours? Have you taken someone's...
Or did you murder someone?
Yeah, did you... do we have anything? Do we have a scoop here? Is there anything that we can go with?
Because the place to confess would obviously be on a podcast.
It would be right here. Yeah. I trust you guys. Yes.
Podcast.
So Just so I'm clear, the manuscript is not well written.
No, you've got a great.
It's a great plot.
It's your story, and you've gone, oh, I can.
And
do
you know
this.
You could do it better
because you're an editor. You can make this better. You know
that would be quite tempting, wouldn't it?
Is this by any? Ever since earlier in the podcast when you tantalizingly mentioned your second novel,
yes.
Is this by any chance the plot to your second novel?
It is not.
Weird.
Although one of the principal characters in the second novel is a celebrated crime writer, more celebrated than I am. Certainly,
I love that you're talking about it. I was going to ask if you're allowed to say anything.
Oh, sure. Yep, yeah. A celebrated crime writer who is interviewed by a young woman aspiring to be his biographer, and she discovers a dark secret in his past. I think I would be tempted. I think I would. Although, as I might have mentioned, I probably didn't actually, because it was only the first time we'd met and I didn't want to weird you out. But now we're all mates, so
now
here's the weird.
Yes, here's that chance.
Here you go. Here you go. Yeah. I think if I were to murder someone, actually, a shove into the river is a really good way of doing it, because that's an act. That might be my new method of, that's my MO now. Previous to this, I would have smothered someone with a pillow. Because it's comfortable for both parties. You know, you're getting smushed with a pillow, but it's not a cinder block. And if you're doing the smushing, you can just sort of lean, take a little nap.
Yeah, stretch some.
Stretch! You could stretch, exactly. Yeah. So.
That's the best bright side to being smothered I've ever heard. It's not a cinder block.
No, it isn't, right? If you're gonna go in comfort.
Only 100% goose down for me.
You're a snob like that.
What I like about the new book, on Goodreads right now, it's called AJ Finn Thriller 2 is on there, and there are people already reviewing it. It doesn't even exist.
Boy.
It's really good stars are rating already.
It does it. Good.
Thriller 2 has quite a ring to it.
It sure does. It does what it says on the tin. Wow. I am... It's not displeased.
But it's great because it that's how when you see someone write a book like this and then people are passing it, like Sarah has been shoving people's hands.
Yes.
And then you've got this anticipation for this next book.
Yes.
And, you know, you've got, I mean, obviously, hopefully, the publisher is going, ride the wave of the success, do as much publicity as you can across your 43?
Well remembered.
43 countries. And then hand in a book in a couple of years. Is that the
that is the plan. Yes. Yeah. And the film version of The Woman in the Window will be released October 4th, 2019 in the States. And I think the week before late September in Australia.
Cool.
So we don't want to muddy the waters by publishing a book before then. Yeah. And I haven't finished writing book two.
Yeah.
I haven't started writing. No, I have started. If anyone's.
The Goodreads people.
Yeah, exactly. I've started writing it if my publishers are listening in, but it's not finished. So that'll be published, we think, in about March 2020. After the movie has been released, after we hope Amy Adams wins an Oscar.
And we're talking Hollywood here. Hollywood has been the seductress of many writers and has stopped them writing. Have you danced with Hollywood? Have they whispered sweet things in your ear? Are you being seduced away from your true calling?
They've whispered sweet things into my ear, but... Having listened to and bought into these sweet things, I went out to Hollywood in May of this year to, quote, take meetings, as they say. And to the next writer who's lucky enough to have happened to them what's happened to me, I will say, keep your ego in check by going out to Hollywood and taking meetings. They are not over-impressed by authors, as far as I could tell. Many of them hadn't read my book, although they were aware of it. So I'm sitting in these meetings feeling thoroughly condescended to and quite diminished. This has impressed upon me that although I would like to work in Hollywood, I would like perhaps to adapt my second novel for television, I might like to write screenplays, novels will remain the backbone of my career. Absolutely. I want to write one every 2 to 2.5 years. I look at authors whom I admire, very much like Gillian Flynn, who's been a hero of mine since Gone Girl and who's been extraordinarily generous to me in supporting The Woman in the Window, and I think, ooh, I really wish we had a new novel from Gillian. She's been busy in Hollywood and very successful. But I want more of her prose. Same with Graham Moore, who wrote The Sherlockian and The Last Days of Night and won an Oscar for his Imitation Game screenplay. He's not writing quite often enough for my liking. So I can assure you, as booksellers, that I am intending to write every 2 to 2.5 years.
I'm so pleased to hear that.
I'm pleased to say it.
Because it is such a time waste. But I can't imagine, I suppose... Everyone gets seduced by it. We had Michael Robotham in here early in the year, and he was talking about screenplay writing and that you're sitting in a room with other people.
It's collaborative like that. Yep.
And he said that it was great fun, and it was like having characters talk to you. But on the other hand, he also preferred
The autonomy,
yeah,
I imagine. Yeah. Yes.
And I can imagine with the way, the precision you've put this thing, this book together, and the way in which you write those chapters, and the choice of language and mm-hmm. and the delivery, that you'd be particular about every line.
And I am. Yeah. It's not that I don't play well with others. I like to think I do to an extent, but one of the things I like so much about writing novels, as opposed to screenplays, and one of the reasons I like the publishing industry so much more than the film/TV industry, is that when you're writing a novel, it's largely down to you. The quality is up to, or as I said, down to you. Likewise, in publishing, when a novel is acquired, it will be published, barring some catastrophe. When a book is optioned for film, it probably won't be made.
Yeah.
So there's an end game in sight, a finish line with publishing.
With success, sometimes that takes the wind out of sails. Like, people put a lot of pressure on themselves.
And yes.
Did you just jump straight into another book because you wanted to be working again? Is that something to keep things rolling? And that pressure for second book just wouldn't be able to build up? Is that something you did on consciously, or is that?
That's a really good question. You, sir, should be a psychotherapist because you're plumbing the depths of my psyche. I came up with the idea for the second book before the first book was submitted to publishers, and I'm very glad it shook out that way because it meant and means that I liked the idea before there was pressure to like it. Yeah. I did take some time off between the submission and acquisition of the first book and the commencement of writing of the second, in part because I needed a break, in part because I wanted to wrap my head around the proposition of the second book. The reason I'm forging ahead with it, apart from the fact that it's contractually obligated, is that I enjoy it. I get a lot of energy out of writing. It depletes me too, but it is my job. And I've always been quite disciplined. It's one of the very few things I have going for me. So every day I will sit down and I will write 1,000 words. I may not use any of them. I might discard all of them, but I do hit that benchmark every day. So I think it generates its own sort of inexorable momentum for me.
And the distractions of Amy Adams.
Yep.
And all this sort of building up.
Yes.
As the year goes through.
Yes.
And you're going to be dragged probably into it more and more.
On the publicity front. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Are you very organized around that stuff as well? You go, yes, I can do that and that, but not these 2 days because that's my writing day. Or is it going to be like that? Are you going to try and manage it, or are you just going to write on the fly?
I think the latter, although I've learned to say no more often. There are all sorts of places I would love to visit in the world, and I'm so privileged to have the opportunity to do so. But increasingly, I have to decline offers simply because I've got work to do. And I realize how whiny this sounds. I want to live my life. I want to get my French bulldog. I want to move flats, etc., etc. The film is a very exciting proposition. It started production earlier this month, and I got to visit the set. I got to meet Amy, and she was wonderful. The set was absolutely extraordinary. I can't wait to meet Julianne Moore and Gary Oldman, who are playing supporting roles in the film. But I'm very much on the periphery of this whole process. I'm totally dispensable. They don't need me anymore.
I think Amy Adams is such a brilliant casting choice.
My idea.
Really? Yeah. Oh, my God. I want to... So I'm assuming, I mean, maybe you haven't, but were you watching Sharp Objects?
I have been watching Sharp Objects.
Is that surreal for you to, like, be a fan of Gillian Flynn, know that Amy's going to be in the movie version of your book, and then see her in a...
Weirdly, there's another connection. The actress Patricia Clarkson, who plays her mother, is a very good friend of mine. So I've got these three ins with Sharp That's Objects. So cool. It is surreal. And I've actually stopped, well, I haven't stopped watching. I paused my viewership after the fourth episode because I didn't want to get too distracted. I do have writing to do, as Dawn was saying. But, it is a bit surreal, not least because her character in Sharp Objects is not wholly dissimilar to the character she's playing in The Woman in the Window. They're both troubled, even disturbed women, although in other respects they're very, very dissimilar. So, yeah, that has been a bit surreal. I think she's...
I can't even imagine it.
Well, one of the things I like so much about Amy Adams, and the reason I instantly said her name when Fox asked me whom I saw in the lead role, is that, to me, she is eminently relatable and likable, but also a very skilled actress. And because this character is frustrating at times, she makes poor choices, she doesn't take care of herself, you want someone who is likable, and you want someone with the chops to steer you through these rapids of her psyche.
I think it's a brilliant choice. I just, my mind struggles to grapple with what it must be like for you where, you know, say a year ago, or I don't know the timeline on it exactly, but like...
About 22 months ago, none of this had happened.
That's crazy.
Yes, yes.
Like, that is a lot of change for a short amount of time.
It sure
is. How are you feeling?
A bit disembodied at this point. When the book was acquired quite expensively and amid much fanfare, I was, of course, supremely excited, but I was still in my job, and I did not intend to leave my job. I had been party myself to big acquisitions, so it was not unfamiliar as an experience. I was in the driver's seat, or maybe the passenger seat, I suppose. Not sure about my metaphor there, but it was not unfamiliar. What has been unfamiliar is the success of the book. I have not been party to a publication of this scale or a publication that has done as well as this. And I'm supremely grateful to my publishers, to the booksellers who have been amazingly supportive, and to the readers, of course. At this point, I've been quite busy. I think I've been at home for 49 days.
Oh, my
goodness. In 2018.
How are you going to get that dog?
This is the question, right? Again, portable, but you can't. You generally can't take Frenchies on planes because they're brachycephalic. They've got those smushed faces, and so their airways are constricted, and it's not unknown for them to die on planes.
Oh.
I know, so I don't want to have to continually kick the dog beneath my seat just to make sure he's still breathing.
So I don't want to end this podcast with a dead dog.
As a loose rule, you, sir, are a professional. Yes.
Good choice.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
I have a question from all the writers who are on the other side of things, and there are thousands of them working away, and is it good, what you've had? Is it something that you would go, I recommend this, having this sort of level of success as a writer? It's definitely worth striving for.
Yes, but there's a caveat, and I realize how whiny this sounds. It is not always fun. It's not often fun, actually. Promoting a book is exhausting. It's exhilarating. It's wonderful to travel the world, to meet booksellers, to meet the readers. And I enjoy it thoroughly. But at the end of the day, you're very tired. And it's tough to carve out time to write, or at least it is for me. I've had to train myself to write on planes and in hotel rooms. So it's something of a mixed blessing, on the whole, very positive. To those readers, or listeners rather, who are writing themselves, I would advise you to remember that writing, much like promoting a book, is a job. And it's not always fun. I would advise you too to remember that it is hard. So don't beat yourself up if you're having trouble. I've enjoyed this measure of success, and my second book has proven really challenging. And I'm sure 12 books from now, it'll still be challenging. So go easy on yourselves.
Love the idea of 12 books.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. It's been such fun.
Oh, and thank you for steering us away from the dead dog.
Shoot.
Unicorns. Tinkerbell.
Rainbows.
Cotton candy. Yeah. There we go. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
And you can get your copy of The Woman in the Window at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.